like the killing of Black people by law enforcement, just seeing Black folks incarcerated, you know, being traumatized, treated unfairly. That Monday when I walked out to go to the protest, in the very beginning when that first wave was starting to happen, like, I just felt really uneasy, and I just knew that I needed to be out there.
What's happening now is people are talking about not just defunding police, but fundamentally redefining what we mean by public safety and who protects them. If you take that premise, you understand that you don't have a police force to address a mental health crisis or a drug addiction issue or a dispute between neighbors.
I read in one Million Dollar Hoods report, right, that two of the top five reasons for people being arrested and going to county jail are, you know, driving with a suspended license and failure to appear in court. Why are these the top two? Like these are two of the top five reasons why people are going to jail. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Tonight, with a mounting national chorus decrying police brutality against Black Americans, there's a new call for deep structural reform of policing across the country. Many are now demanding departments be defunded, dismantled, or outright abolished.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangsta.
South Los Angeles. In mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history, including the Watts Rebellion in 1965 and the L.A. Uprising in 1992.
The South Central Rooted podcast will explore the connection between these events, along with the generations of institutional neglect and intentional exploitation that preceded them. This legacy of oppression still affects South L.A. residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing, unemployment, transportation, policing, and the environment. The combination of these problems has serious consequences for community health.
What we've come to realize is that this racist architecture cannot be dismantled piece by piece at a time when South LA residents are increasingly vulnerable to multiple forms of harassment, displacement, and erasure. While South LA has been a testing ground for racist policy, it has also been a real-life laboratory for innovative solutions.
This is because South LA's grassroots leaders know that to address these complex issues or intersectional problems, we must change the system itself. Drawing on research and local knowledge, this podcast identifies where Band-Aid solutions have failed, where gains have been made, and where future opportunities lie in South LA.
If you're from South Central and familiar with its history, then some of these stories will seem familiar or even nostalgic. But if you're new to South Central or South Central's new to you, well, get ready for an education and welcome to the neighborhood. This is
South Central Rooted.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
Welcome to part two of the South Central Rooted webinar series. This conversation holds a magnifying glass to the recent uprisings in response to recent incidents and broader suffocating culture of police brutality, something South LA is all too familiar with. Our guests talk about the protests here in LA, the historical foundations of racial inequities in Los Angeles and in policing in general, and the organizing movements that have been working to address over-policing in South LA, past and present. And don't forget to check out part one of our webinar series for a compelling conversation about health disparities in South LA and social conditions that drive them through the lens of the coronavirus pandemic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Marlo J., one of your co-hosts for the podcast South Central Rooted, which was developed by the South LA Building Healthy Communities Collaborative and based on the recently released report by the same name. It demonstrates how the intersecting and systemic nature of racism has shaped South Central's history and current landscape. The report and podcast lays out four key drivers of disparity as a way of understanding the root causes and current state of inequity in South Los Angeles. These four drivers of disparity are gentrification, displacement, and homelessness, poverty, disinvestment, and joblessness, policing suppression, deportation and mass incarceration, and environmental racism. The podcast and report combine history, data, and the voices of residents and local organizers to help us understand how Black and brown communities on the front lines of systemic racism and deep inequity are the ones who are leading the way towards real, meaningful change. We realize that conversations and political education tools are critically important in our current moment, and we face a collective reckoning with the legacy of white supremacy and anti-Black racism in our society. Now, why have these sessions, and why now? I'm glad you asked. The purpose of this learning session is because the relentless police brutality has sparked worldwide protests for Black lives and calling to defund the police. Organizing efforts around the world show solidarity and demand for justice and systemic change.
And we begin with growing calls to defund the police. Today, eight members of the New York City Council are proposing a plan aimed at cutting $1 billion from the NYPD's budget in the upcoming fiscal year.
On Sunday, a majority of Minneapolis City Council members pledged their commitment to defund the city's police department.
A majority of Seattle City Council members pledged to defund its police department by 50%.
A new plan to cut millions of dollars from the Berkeley Police Department.
Austin is looking at massive, sweeping changes to policing.
Mayor Eric Garcetti says he and the city council have agreed to take $250 million from the city budget from every department, this including LAPD, and redirect the money to social programs that help minorities and the underserved.
We are going to take this rage, we are going to take this grief, and we are going to take it from the streets and bring it to the policymakers and demand change.
This virtual learning session will be an opportunity to dig deep into the history of oppression and uprising in South LA, explain what was born out of the 28 years since the 1992 uprising, and by the community outline the 2020 vision, which includes discussing calls to action, strategies for community healing, and defining power building during a pandemic. Now, let's get to know our esteemed panelists. Oshanae R. Gilliam is a policy and community liaison at Community Health Councils, a South LA-based health and policy nonprofit. She earned a Master's of Public Policy from the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. She went to Beloit College for undergrad, majoring in political science and Russian. Oshanae is passionate about creating equitable policies and eradicating disparities that harm Black communities. She is an avid dancer and likes going on hikes with her dog, Curly. Hey, Curly. Oshanae, thank you for being here to talk to us about your perspective and to ground us in the current iteration of massive movement for justice. As a policy and community liaison at Community Health Councils, and an organizer, and an activist, and a young citizen of our city, what was your call to action to participate in this level of protesting, and why was it important?
Thank you. Participating in the protest was very personal, probably like so many other people who are out there. So when I was a little girl, I used to pick dandelions, the ones with the little fuzzy things on top, because I was told that those were angels. So every morning when I would walk to school, I would pick one of these and I would blow them out, and I would just wish and pray that my brother was released from prison. So my brother, Lil Ruben, he was incarcerated when he was a teen, but he was tried as an adult. And he's been in there since he was 16 years old. Now I think he's like about 36, 35. And I think that's not fair. I think that's totally not fair. And just with all of the, like the killing of Black people by law enforcement, just seeing Black folks incarcerated, you know, being traumatized, treated unfairly. That Monday when I walked out to go to the protest in the very beginning when that first wave was starting to happen, like I just felt really uneasy and I just knew that I needed to be out there. So that's why I went out, just because I knew that I needed to and I felt in my heart that that was the right thing to do for me.
Absolutely. What were your concerns about participating in this call to action? Did you have any?
Yeah, I think that, you know, aside from the obvious COVID-19 situation, my biggest fear, honestly, was being arrested. I did end up being arrested. I was just very scared because I know how abusive and just how merciless cops and LAPD can be. So I was just really scared that if I was arrested and I'll be booked, I'll be put into prison. I just don't know how I would have handled that. But when I was arrested, you know, that was just still a terrible situation. On the spectrum, I think that, you know, compared to what other people get, I got like the lighter kind of situation, but I was still, you know, detained for several hours. I was still held on a LAPD or a county sheriff bus for hours, not really knowing what's going on. I'm not really being spoken to by officers, and just really just feeling completely unheard, not listened to, just feeling that, I don't know, I just really wasn't treated even just like a free person. And so that was really my biggest fear, was being arrested and just being hurt by law enforcement.
I can imagine. I can imagine, especially considering, you know, that what your brother went through.
Yeah.
So what do you hope that comes from this action?
My biggest hope is that we really rethink community safety. I think defunding LAPD, defunding law enforcement is definitely the right direction to go. I think if I had one concrete thing, definitely it would be taking police out of schools, at least for black and brown children. I don't think police, you know, make us feel safe. When I was in school, I never felt safe when I was around law enforcement. Actually, the exact opposite, because I just had so many, you know, bad experiences with law enforcement since I was just even a kid. And growing up, just a lot of bad interactions. They just don't need to be there. And so that's what I will hope to see, and actually see more investment and stuff that's more geared towards like mental health for kids, especially for Black kids who face a lot of like daily trauma. So like more like therapists or like, I don't know, art classes, like something like that. Like let's like really invest in their future and not actually just get them ready to try to like go to prison, you know? So that's what I hope.
That's absolutely needed. Did you feel more connected, or did you gain a better understanding of the community while you were protesting?
Absolutely. So I've been protesting for a while now. Like the first protest I really went to was Trayvon Martin's protest, and I went there with my little brother. And at that protest, you know, went to Limerick Park, and we were there with our people. And I was like, you know, I think something's really going to change from this. But, you know, of course, things kind of like stay the same in a lot of regards. So going to this protest, you know, while from that point, it was very different in that it was more diversified, I guess. But I think what really just struck me was just like the emotion, like the protest specifically I went to, I think it was just like a group of people coming together, and it was really spearheaded by folks on bikes, and then also spearheaded by like a few Black young men. And I just think that was just really like powerful, just to hear folks really like speaking up and speaking out against that. But then also just being there with all those people, especially like in a moment during a pandemic, I don't know, it really made me feel like those folks there really do like feel like Black lives like matter, like know that for a fact, you know? And that felt really powerful to me. And I felt very connected to like other communities like I have not been like before.
I first became politicized during the Rodney King verdict. You know, prior to the verdict, we were working on different issues already, and we had done small protests, you know, in front of, you know, liquor stores, and you know, we did small protests, you know, and at the Capitol, but it felt like having so many people that together for the same reason, it felt bigger than anything else. You know, it felt bigger than anything else, and it felt like you weren't alone. It felt like other people had the same thought and had the same feeling, and you were all, you know, working together for something, some common cause, you know? Did you go to a lot of the protests this past June?
Yeah, I went to a few. The most recent one I went to was down in Long Beach. It was a Black Lives Matter / like Trans Lives Matter and LGBTQI Lives Matter protest. And so I thought that was also just like really beautiful as well, to like really like uplift like Black trans lives. And because I felt like not a lot of people really think about those different intersectionalities. And I think it's really important that we also like raise that stuff up. So yeah, definitely been to like a few, just because like I said, just something in my heart that like it just gets me out the door. Like it really gets me out the door. And just knowing that this is not just localized to LA, because you know, LA is kind of thought of like this like progressive city or whatever, but to know that it's happening literally like all over, and there are folks who are living in more dangerous areas than like I live in, like just in terms of like safety, like like, I don't want to stereotype, but like the South kind of vibe. Like, I don't know. I think I feel a lot differently there versus like in LA. So just seeing just like a unified movement like that, I think it's amazing. I really do.
It is. You know, I agree. What would you say to mobilize people of your age? Like, you know, they feel defeated or indifferent about policing and the systemic racism. What do you think we need to do to get through to people of your generation, for those that are like, it's not really my issue?
Right. I think that definitely, I'm on Instagram and seeing like a lot of the movement just in terms of like Black Lives Matter or In This Together LA, like all of these like Instagram accounts, I think that's excellent. But honestly, like my number one thing would just be like, just like vote. In 2016, when Trump got elected and I was still in grad school, the Black Students United, group had like this little powwow, and folks were saying, how they're scared, whatever, because, Trump got elected. I'm just like, look, y'all, we got to start voting. Like, I mean, at the local level, like everything, it's not just about like the primaries or just about like the elections, but like, we got to start voting at like every single election. So I think that my biggest like push would be really get involved with your local kind of like politics. Cause I think that's how we kind of like move things like inch by inch in order to get like that true like system change effect, because we got to like turn the little gear. So please register to vote and vote. And if you're not 18, like do some canvassing. Like I think that's just like really important.
Do you feel like we need to use more of the social media to get to these people, to these people? I sound like them, don't I? But to get to this generation, so they can understand the importance, because I think that everyone kind of understands the importance of voting, for the primary, but what about the local, the school district, the council, the different propositions that will affect you directly, in your neighborhood, in your city, in your state? Do you feel like they understand that? Do you feel like we need to do a better job at explaining to them how this is important?
Yeah, I think that definitely we need to do a better job, because I got a master's in public policy and I'm still confused how stuff works at the city and county level. Like what's going on, And I definitely feel like using social media, because I think that social media really help things like boom out, because information gets shared so quickly. So if we can really be on like all the platforms like Instagram, TikTok, I mean, like a lot of people don't really use Facebook that much. I feel like, but like Facebook, I don't know, but just every single like platform that we possibly can. But also it's really important to get like younger folks to also like chip in on that, just so that the messages really connect, So
right.
100% definitely.
Like from younger folks to younger folks.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Oh my God. Thank you so much. Oh, Shanae, you are something special. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on. Let's meet Mary Lee. Mary M. Lee consults with community-based organizations, public officials, government agencies, and philanthropy to dismantle racial bias systems and structures and build just and equitable neighborhoods. She is a former deputy director of Policy Link, a national advocacy organization working to advance racial equity and social justice. A practicing attorney for over 25 years, Lee has experience using civil rights, land use, and economic development strategies to revitalize neighborhoods and enhance public participation in the policy arena, with an emphasis on the legal rights of low-income people. She's also one of our speakers on the first episode of South LA BHC's podcast series, South Central Rooted. My first question, what was the cultural and political landscape of South Central at the time of the 92 Rebellion?
So I'm really happy to be here, first and foremost, and always happy to talk to you, Marlo, but I just am sort of gratified that our communities are having these kinds of conversations. So thank you, and to everyone who's part of organizing of this discussion today, that putting it together. We really need a lot of these sorts of platforms. And of course, I can't answer a question without adding to the question, and I'm going to add to it a little bit, because it's important to look even further back than 92 to just understand how that culture was shaped. The focus of our discussion today is policing, but it is in a larger context all about power and frankly, when it comes to issues of race and racial injustice, about using power to oppress people. And our policing system in this country has its roots in oppression and its roots in maintaining the separations in society that are based on race. So people, I think most people now are hearing in the discussions that have been happening recently of the roots of policing in slave patrols or slave catchers, if you want to call them that. Our modern policing really is connected to all of that. And it's worked extraordinarily well. These are not broken systems. These are systems that are rigged. They're fixed. They're supposed to work the way they're working. And you can look all the way back into all kinds of places all over the country in different eras to see how violent and oppressive and genocidal those forces were. So for Black people, and that's only one category of people that have been oppressed by policing, but when you take it up through the Jim Crow era, through first Reconstruction and then Jim Crow era, that's how you enforced these societal barriers, these racial barriers, through what came to become modern policing. And even though Los Angeles seemed very far away from the South, seemed like it wasn't a place where those strict racial laws of the Black codes and things like that were in existence and enforced, it's really not true. Los Angeles has a history of being extraordinarily separated and segregated and racially segregated, and that type of segregation was enforced by police. People sometimes think, oh, Los Angeles was always progressive or modern or more advanced. Well, it wasn't and it isn't. And so, way back in the day, the same sorts of Southern approaches to enforcing segregation that were evident in other parts of the country were evident here in Los Angeles. And you have to remember that Los Angeles was the location, the destination for a lot of Black people, for example, who moved from the South during two big waves of migration. And that migration was in some ways fueled by looking for jobs, but was often fueled by trying to escape from extraordinarily racist violence and lynchings and Ku Klux Klan, and just again, policing, quote unquote, policing, enforcing these Black codes that separated people, criminalized really just being Black and any other kind of regular behavior. Loitering was a crime, and loitering could be punished by putting people on a chain gang and, on and on and on and on. So, but again, to bring it back to the culture of Los Angeles, Los Angeles had extraordinarily violent policing and corrupt policing as well. Very much known all over the country for how corrupt its police force had been. When you fast forward a little bit to the late 1950s, early 1960s, when there was a civil rights movement and Los Angeles was a participant, Black people were active in civil rights marches and demonstrations against discrimination in housing, against employment discrimination. You need to understand that police were in place to put that down, to put that resistance down and contain the population of dissent or questioning. And they did it, and they did it very violently and very brutally. Los Angeles was also extraordinarily economically stratified. So people of color, particularly Black people, were very, very poor and were segregated into areas and kept away by practice and custom, if not by law, from living in white areas. Restrictive covenants existed on a whole bunch of property. And so, Black people didn't live west of Central Avenue in the 1940s, 1950s. That slowly began to change. And I'm quickly trying to get you to the 90s, because what you need to appreciate is by 1965, when the Watts rebellions happened, you had a relationship between police and the Black community that was contentious and confrontational, but not because Black people were picking on the police, but because they were in a defensive position always. And that policy of containing and controlling, not protecting and serving, was the way in which police interacted. After the Watts Rebellion and the economic bottom fell out of South Los Angeles, factories closed, thousands of jobs were lost. So you had this community that had a very short period of time where folks were starting to move into a lower middle class lifestyle, and the rug was pulled out from under them when those plants closed. And that set up these social structures where there was a lack of jobs. People started losing their housing because that's what happens when you don't have a job. Home ownership, which had been just starting to happen in the 50s and 60s, that became really fragile for Black people. And, you know, you had this situation or circumstance where there was just a sense of despair. And then you ended up with even more violent and brutal policing as drugs began to flood into South Los Angeles, particularly PCP epidemic and then the crack epidemic. And at the same time, this is always interesting to me, history happens and there's things happening simultaneously. Simultaneously, there was tremendous intervention on the part of the US in Central America, which caused massive immigration, actually refugee, fleeing war and conflict in El Salvador and Guatemala, Honduras, places like that. Particularly El Salvador and Guatemala. And so Central American refugees began to flood into Los Angeles and they came to South LA. And that set up a construct where you had Latino migrants who were not necessarily embraced by the more stable Mexican, Mexicano, Chicano population in the eastern part of the city, but were on their own in South LA. So that created some conflict because the economic forces exploited them and sometimes pitted them against the Black population. So Black population was on the decline in terms of economic stability, losing houses. The new Central American migrants were being sort of used to replace them in housing particularly. And so South LA, the demographics of South LA changed in the late 70s, early 80s to the early 90s, like overnight. There had been very few Latinos living in South LA, and then suddenly there was a large percentage of Latinos, but most of them were Central American and not Mexican. So the last point I want to make, I'm still trying to answer your question about the culture in the 90s, because the culture that led up to the 92 response to the verdict against the police officers, or verdict in favor of the police officers in the Rodney King beating, was that there had been an enormous amount of political activism by community members. So, much like now, never let it be said that community residents were only acting individually, although I think they did that. And you know, people do feel driven to protest and to respond out of frustration. But there were active and skilled community activists and organizers operating in the 80s and 90s who called into question the way that policing was being done in Los Angeles, had been done under Daryl Gates. We had in the 80s an era of incredibly brutal policing. So the battering ram, people may hear about this, Police Chief Daryl Gates, who believed that to fight drugs, and the war on drugs was another facet of this policing approach, and obsessive policing at that, he would use this battering ram. It's like a tree trunk attached to a tank and knock down houses to look for drugs. And often go to the wrong house. So in the same way you hear about the no-knock warrants and Breonna Taylor's murder, This was happening in places in Los Angeles. There had been a raid on a house, I think it was on Dalton Street, where they tore the house up, wrong house. So that, there were activists in the community. I was part of a group that tried to challenge policing and police misconduct and found lawyers to sue the police department for brutality. There were cases of incredible police brutality, the Eula Love murder, where Eula Love was an African-American mom who had a dispute with the power company. She paid her utility bill, but the utility came to cut off her service, and she went out on her front step and told them they couldn't do it. She had a little kitchen knife with her, told them to get off the property. They called the police. Police emptied their service revolvers into her in broad daylight in front of her children. And that was just one case. There was the Olympics, and in preparation for the Olympics, the excessive policing in Los Angeles that just, again, put people down, sweeps to take them out of their communities. So all of this was the backdrop to the 80s when, or the 90s, really, by the time that Natasha Harlan was murdered and the person who murdered her had little or no consequence. Even though it was captured on there were images of the murder. So all of these sorts of things were the backdrop for the 92 arrest. And I just need to tell you, I think Oshine, and I'm going to say her name wrong, Oshine?
Yep.
Just speaking, was talking about, that whole feeling of what moves you and the things that motivate people to get active and how she felt being part of those protests. You said it too, Marlo, about what it felt like to be part of something big. I remember in 92 when the city erupted, just like instantaneous response to the verdict. On one level, it seemed as if I thought people had stopped feeling, that we were so numb by the onslaught of the drug epidemic, the crack epidemic, loss of jobs, the loss of housing, the despair, the separation in society. And in some ways, the fact that people were furious was a sign to me that they were there. They felt. And the question is how to channel that. So anyway, I've talked way too long, and I know, my brother David has a lot of expertise in this same arena. But I have more to say. Unfortunately, I have all these notes, but I will stop. And see if that answered some of your questions.
Well, I wanted to have, I had a sub question because I with all this that happened as a backdrop, right, for the I want to say boiling over of the 92 rebellion, do you feel like the cultural, that culturally the police are the same or different in terms of the culture that they built back in the 70s and 80s of, because it was like I want to say I read somewhere, or maybe you told me because I mix that up often, but I read somewhere that it was a bunch of cops brought from southern states, to south central LA. And it was they were mostly white and they just had this mentality of, of just pretty much, just get these people in line or get them in jail. And do you feel like that culture that began back then still is the same right now in policing practices and policy?
Always been the same. And it creates an us against them mentality. I mean, again, if you trace policing back to slave patrols, you understand that the intentionality of the people who design police forces, and that may not be in the heart of individual officers, it's enough to me about individual officers, but it's putting people into a system and indoctrinating them and training them in a manner so that their conduct serves the purpose you want them there for. And if the purpose is to protect property, and believe me, slaves were property, people were mortgaged, human beings were mortgaged, they were counted as well, we were counted as well. And so the notion of my property is being damaged, you have to protect it, you have to bring it back, you have to, you know, keep it the way I want it. And that extends now to, you know, to land, to material possessions. And that's the purpose of policing. So, you know, what's happening now is people are talking about not just defunding police, but fundamentally redefining what we mean by public safety and who protects it. If you take that premise, you understand that you don't have a police force to address a mental health crisis or a drug addiction issue or a dispute between neighbors. And if the major purpose of the police is to prevent crime and solve crime, I hate to say this, but they aren't doing a very good job. they're not. And so you really don't call them to prevent crime at all. You only call them after a crime has been committed. And I don't know if any of you have had experience with calling the police and seeing, do they solve your burglary? Do they solve the murder? Do they solve the rape? And the percentages aren't great. The LA Times just did an analysis even of 911 calls and showed that very few of them are for violent crime. And almost the majority of all the crimes they instigate, which means they're stopping someone on their own volition and saying, we have a problem out here on the street. Nobody called me. I just saw this guy walking down the street.
Right. It's like, I see these people over here being black. That's crazy.
I decided to pull them over in my own judgment. So back to your question about, are they different? I don't think their training is necessarily different. I think it's actually been refined. They're more militarized. They're more militarized in their equipment. They're more militarized in their, in their indoctrination. They're treated as if they're trained to treat every encounter as potentially fatal to them. And so they operate from that premise. They operate from the premise that we're being threatened by anything, and so we have to defend ourselves. And until very recently, the popular consciousness was, that's right, we don't want to do that job. And so we're going to back them up. When they say they're threatened, we're not even going to question whether that was reasonable. We're just going to say, we felt it. So our television shows, you know, Law and Order and Crime Scene Investigation, all these shows underscore that. What in law would be called the presumptions are in their favor. The ability to have freedom from liability, you know, that they're not liable for all kinds of things. All of these immunity, that's the word I'm looking for, all these kinds of theories, we accept them on face value. That's what I mean by saying the system's not broken. It's rigged. It's designed to help them, and by them I mean the system that police are. And again, remember, the police are the lowest rung on this ladder. They're the thing that that most people of color, low-income people, oppressed people encounter first.
Yes.
And so it's unfortunate, frankly, that we're only looking at that aspect of the entire racist structure of our society.
Absolutely.
We're here and we have a chance to make some changes here. I think we should definitely seize the opportunity.
Yes, this is a great time to bring David in. David C. Turner III is an activist scholar from Inglewood, California. As the manager of the Brothers Sun Selves, David leads a coalition of 10 community-based organizations working to end the school-to-prison pipeline and decriminalize communities of color. David currently teaches at the collegiate level, including classes on hip-hop, research methods, education, and comparative ethnic studies. David receives his BA in Africana Studies from Cal State University Dominguez Hills and his MS-Ed in Higher Education from the University of Pennsylvania. On top of that, he is currently a fifth-year doctoral candidate in the Social and Cultural Studies and Education program at UC Berkeley, where his research focuses on youth-based social movements, political identity, and resistance to the prison regime. What do you think about the culture of LAPD and the culture of policing?
Well, first of all, thank you again for having me. And I definitely want to underscore something that Mary Lee said, right? That that the culture of policing in and of itself has not changed, right? I think a talking point that the LAPD would give you is that, oh, our force now is more diverse than ever. That's one of their talking points. Now, the counter to that is that now that we can track complaints, now that we can track how you all have been killing folks, how you've been stopping folks, right? Your new diversity has not improved the situation, right? Because again, the function of law enforcement in this country has been to suppress and control, right? So I definitely want to, I think, underscore that when we're talking about policing and we're talking about law enforcement, because again, if their primary function is to suppress and control, right, and specifically to suppress and control certain bodies, certain neighborhoods, certain geographies, right, like I think it's important for us to name that, right? And when we think about so many of the uprisings, right, that are people of color led, that are we think about so much of the organizing that's happened, it's happened specifically because of police, right? For example, when we think about Pride, right, the first Pride was a legit uprising led by, you know, trans women of color, Black trans women specifically, right, because police kept busting up their places, you know, right, when we think about what happened in 65, what happened in 92, what happened in Detroit, what happened all over the country, again, it's because law enforcement continuously antagonizes folks because they're trying to suppress and control, right? So I think the transformation, you know, the transformation in this particular moment, right, you know, people have talked about care not cages or care not cops, right? Like the underlying sort of point of that is we need care, not control. You know, like we don't need you to try and overly control our communities, because what we need is the support, because we aren't really trying to do bad, right? I think to again to Mary Lee's point earlier, when we start talking about I think the history and the transition, right, from post civil rights until the 90s, right? One of the things that we saw, you know, not only the taking away of jobs, right, was also the systemic divestment from all other resources, right? You know, as California became increasingly more brown, right, the education budget also it began to decrease systemically, right? We saw in this particular state, how, right, like we went from one of the top 10 in education spending down to the bottom 10, right? And that's because the majority of young people who are going to California schools are no longer white, right? So again, right, like I think, you know, as we're talking about policing, I think that one, it has been about control, and two, as we have these broader conversations about race and about racism, right, like we have to understand that policing is just the one most visible sort of avenue that then opens the door for all of these broader conversations about how communities of color, Black communities in this particular case, but communities of color in general, right, have been systemically divested from. In addition to that, have also there have been tensions that have been brought up and then intentionally fueled, right, by this system within communities of color, right, to prevent folks from working together to address these issues, right? So I don't want to miss that, because I think that's also a central point. But yeah, man, as we're talking about the culture of policing, right, as we're talking about the culture of the LAPD or the LA County Sheriff's or whatever law enforcement agency we'll see, right, we have to understand that it's a part of a broader issue, and that issue is fundamentally rooted in anti-Blackness.
What about LAPD made it a militarized organization? How has that mentality been displayed in different aspects of South Central community?
Well, so first off, right, like I think when we talk about the militarization of folks, we have to remember that it's that, again, right, like the infrastructure to control folks, right, had been invested in and developed, right, for decades. I think a piece of that, right, again, going back to some of that history, was connected to Operation Hammer here in Los Angeles, right, as a part of the first, as a part of one of the militarizations, right, when we think even about how law enforcement had more sophisticated technology, right, like, you know, their first gang database, right, the alpha file tracking that they had was a part of a data agreement between LAUSD and the police, right, back in the 70s. You know, the first school that they piloted that at was Crenshaw High School. And then when we start thinking about now, right, like, yes, it is LAPD, but you also have other law enforcement agencies who have militarized equipment. So again, I manage the Brother Son Sales Coalition. We're a coalition of organizations that do work with boys and young men of color. One of our partners, the Labor Community Strategy Center, won a campaign to end something called the 1033 program, right? Now, this particular program, right, within different law enforcement agencies, but specifically school districts, authorized law enforcement to purchase military equipment at a low cost. So we had school police officers with grenade launchers and assault rifles. Why do you need that? right? So, and again, right, I'm saying, you know, so our partners at the Strategy Center have worked to get rid of that particular program, right? But again, you know, like what underlying assumptions do you have to have about young people and the communities that you serve, right, to where you think a grenade launcher is necessary? You know, what kind of underlying assumptions, right, do you need to have about, you know, communities, right, to think it's okay, right, to take a battering ram and tear down somebody's house? You know, like, what kind of underlying assumptions do you need to have, right, in a very recent report about gang databases? One of our partners, the Youth Justice Coalition, has been working on that issue for a while, right? Like, what kind of assumptions do you need to have to intentionally misplace people into gang databases so that way you can track them and that way you can you can continue to harm them, right? Again, you know, like one of the things that that has changed, I think, is some of the language. One of the things that has not changed is the ways in which how law enforcement continues to try and control certain communities, right, and how they use various tools in order to do that, right? So again, you know, they could no longer, so because of civil rights, because of that work, right, you know, to end de jure segregation, you know, now other tools have to be created. So what are these tools? Now they're gang injunctions, right? You know, where you put a gang injunction on an entire neighborhood. You know, now, right, you have these different databases, right? You know, now people are being criminalized for poverty, you know, or people are being criminalized for, you know, some of the smallest things. I read in $1 million hoods report, right, that two of the top five reasons for people being arrested and going to county jail are, you know, driving with a suspended license and failure to appear in court. Why are these the top two? Like these are two of the top five reasons why people are going to jail. Like that doesn't make sense, you know? So again, right, as we're thinking about this work, and as we're thinking about like how we advance in this work, one of the things that's going to be important, not only, you know, this broad redefinition of public safety, but I think is getting at that underlying root cause of this country's need, or this country's, I think, inherently anti-Black and racist desire, right, to control Black populations, right, to control them and over-criminalize them. You know, that has to be specifically addressed, right, if we're going to try and advance any real sense of racial justice or social justice in general.
agreed on all levels. Yes, because you have to have, in order for you to justify these means, you have to have some kind of anti-Black or systemic racist thoughts or assumptions. But I want to ask of either of you or both of you, what do you think that are some, what do you think are some negative long-term health effects of that are seen by the residents of South Central because of the over-policing? Or do you see any?
So I'm starting. The health effects are the same for South LA residents that are African American, Black, as they are, frankly, nationally. Shortened lifespan, high levels of infant mortality, all kinds of existing illnesses that are often preventable, but that are exacerbated by stress and the stress of racism, as well as by environmental factors, which are a result in many instances, in most instances, of environmental injustice. And so you see high levels of diabetes and asthma and other kinds of respiratory diseases, like certain sorts of cancers. And then obviously what we're talking about now in terms of violence, both the violence, the interpersonal violence, the random violence, which is in itself a symptom of living in a racist society, as well as the violence that's perpetrated by a publicly paid for law enforcement officer or another system. Frankly, there are other systems that are publicly and public funds are doing it, contributing to the death of Black people. And so this is a constant. I want to make a point or two, because when David was talking about anti-Blackness, you can't stop this tracing and tracking from the colonial era, the enslavement, and the capture and enslavement of Black people and their forced location here to the United States, and then during enslavement, and then afterward. This whole definition of Black people as being subhuman, and so therefore anything goes, and all these narratives that have been formed, refined, redefined, adjusted for the era that we find ourselves in, but really say the same thing. And so all of this to justify the theft of land, you know, the taking people's land in Africa, the capture and extraction of labor and the utilization of bodies to mortgage, as I said before, to accrue wealth for others based on their ownership, breeding Black people. The number of Black people grew exponentially after Blacks arrived here, because Black people were bred so that the slave owners would own more and have greater wealth. And that thinking has been passed down and shapes generations and generations and generations of people who therefore buy into the narrative that folks are not worth as much and aren't entitled as much. And then when it suited the society's purposes, the narrative was shifted from slaves being docile and happy and needing to be live in a structured environment that slavery provided, to suddenly they're the most violent and dangerous people that walk the face of the earth. And so therefore, any little infraction has to be intercepted. Loitering, vagrancy, all of these crimes were actually created to label Black people. And then to add insult to the injury, those criminal, quote unquote, criminal acts become the basis for fines or jaywalking or loitering. Then when you don't pay the fine, you have to pay a fee for when they do finally catch up to you, and then there's interest on the fee. This is modern day poorhouse. This is modern day. What it is, it's indentured servitude. You never work out of it. And it's another thing that keeps Black people and, you know, Black people and other people of color in the lower rungs of society, so that you're working minimum wage jobs and they're the same service jobs that you can equate to the role in enslavement. It's food service, janitorial, personal care, raising children, taking care of sick people, taking care of the elderly. And then that work is talked about as being unskilled and low wage, even though now it's essential services. It's all these things that are essential, driving that bus. And yet they're poorly paid, no health insurance, no career path, no control over your work hours. So, you know, again, I think it's important for us as we try to come up with transforming our society to understand how deep this is and how intractable it is. It's in everything. It's in every aspect of our society. And it really is the strongest piece of that anti-Black attitude that is so pervasive.
David? Do you
can you repeat?
That's okay. We'll take all you've given. David, do you think that there are any long-term health disparities that the people, the residents of South Central LA have, in addition to what Mary said, that we've continued to have, or we've developed because of the over-policings and the policies that have developed in past years?
So let's get personal for a minute, right? So I'm the only member of my immediate family to not be incarcerated. My mother, my sister, and my father have all been incarcerated, all for various reasons. When my mother was incarcerated, she was having a mental health episode, and they put her in Linwood Correctional on a 72-hour hold and kept her for a full week. For my father, he at one point in time was incarcerated for other things right back in the 80s during the war on drugs, things of that nature. And then, as I got older and was a teenager, my dad was routinely, incarcerated for a week at a time, 2 weeks at a time for not having a driver's license or driving with, without registration. My sister, when she was incarcerated, because she had gotten, her and her boyfriend were having, domestic violence concerns. And the one time that she protected herself, she went to jail for that. So she, essentially what, feminists, our Black feminists, would call survived and punished, where she was a survivor of domestic violence, but punished for it. Right. So I think, personally speaking, right. Like, yes, it definitely has an effect on our lives. I think the broader concern is that in each one of those situations, we didn't need police, right? I think the work of Black Lives Matter, of People's Budget LA, people who have been engaged in that broader conversation have worked to help to change the narrative around, well, we don't need police for some of these problems, for a lot of these problems, right? Both my parents, have passed, right? Both before they were 60. There's so much other support that they needed, so much other support that they could have benefited from, right? Health wise, socially, whether or not we're talking about jobs, whether or not we're talking about different health interventions, et cetera. There's so much things that they could have used that they didn't get, because of, our overinvestment in criminalization, So does it have an impact on health? Absolutely. I think, you know, my entire family has experienced what that is and what that looks and feels like, you know, and this is about policing, but it's deeper than policing as well. You know, my entire family at one point lived along the Crenshaw corridor from, you know, 54th and Crenshaw all the way to 116th and Crenshaw in Inglewood, you know, and now myself, my cousin Damon, a few other of my cousins, were some of the last people here to live in LA because everybody else got pushed out to no longer afford to live here, you know. So again, right, like I think, you know, some academics we'll call it anti-blackness's total climate, right? Like where literally every aspect of your life is impacted, right, by this particular form of, you know, of oppression. And I think as we're talking about the health effect, right, of policing, that is one particular aspect of just how these broader social systems work together to harm community. You know, so I think like that has to be named. And also too, right, like one of the things that we have to do is we have to, you know, work with our communities, help to cultivate their leadership. And so that way we can provide that counter story. We can provide that counter narrative. A lot of people, when they talk about law enforcement, they think of law enforcement as helpful. They think of law enforcement as, you know, the people who they see on TV, right? Like I think, you know, it was brought up earlier to Mary Lee's point, like, well, we think about CSI, we think about all these different cop shows, we think about Bad Boys, right? Like we think about those things. But that's not what law enforcement is and what it does, right? Like, you know, those are dramatized versions of some things that aren't necessarily true. What they do is over-penalize and over-control certain populations, and we invest way too much money in that when that money could go towards other things. You know, again, so one of my buddies, Justin Marks, he said that, you know, police don't make communities safer, resources do. You know, so when we talk about the long-term health effects of policing, right, like it's indicative of the broader sort of divestment in our communities. And that's one of the things that I think the community has been challenging is, you know, our over-reliance and over-investment in law enforcement, because that does have an impact on people's health.
Thank you. I feel like the two of you talking about this is like so powerful. It's like you guys have all the information that we need. It's like just being able to get it.
I don't know about all that.
I just feel like it that's what I feel. That's how I feel. But okay, what policies do you think that for both of you? What policies do you feel that remain unchanged when dealing with police brutality?
So the question is, what policies do you think we should change, or what policies should remain unchanged?
What policies that are unchanged right now that should change when it deal with police and police brutality? What do you think that historically they keep keeping on those same policies or reword them to where they're this pretty much the same thing? Like, for example, if you say, okay, we need to get rid of chokeholds. We did that back in 92, you know, and then some kind of way it crept back in, and now we have to change it again and make that illegal again, make those chokeholds illegal again. What do you think continues to be put in the policies that allow us to be brutalized and harassed by police that need to change?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, first foremost, before we do anything else, is just defund the police. I mean, I think that's, you know, when we start talking about policy interventions, tweaks to their powers, other things, you know, like it's one thing to, I think, name that, and there are a bunch of different ways that we can address, you know, law enforcement's power. But First part just has to be like, y'all have way too much money and just give us that. Like, no, like you don't, you like to give you an example from LAPD's budget, right? What LAPD is spending this year on new tasers, right, could, you know, purchase, you know, most buildings in South LA for them to have, you know, for them to run a community-based organization, right? They're spending $1.5 million on new tasers. They're spending $6 million on new cars. I'm not sure if y'all saw that new LAPD Tesla, right, that's been floating around on social media, but that's actually a thing. You know, they spend as much money on printers as most nonprofit organizations get to be sustainable, which is roughly around $2 million, right? So, yeah, just defund the police, right? Like, that's it. You know, like some of that stuff just is not necessary, right? I think that's the first piece. The second piece, right, is, well, as we're looking at these different forms of law enforcement, what functions do they serve? And then how do these particular functions, how can we reimagine them so that way that it's not law enforcement engaging in it? And it doesn't have, I think, to, you know, to one of my partners from the Strategy Center's point, it doesn't have that enforcement-based response, right? Like, you know, again, right? Like when we start talking about this idea of enforcement, we get back to that underlying notion of control. We get back to that underlying notion of we want to control this population. We want to control these particular folks. So, so how do we address that? How do we change that? Well, you know, so let's say, for example, someone gets pulled over for a broken taillight, right? You know, what happens if the city has a program to give vouchers to people to take to an auto shop to go get that taillight fixed? And then, you know, that voucher can then be cashed in at the end of the week or end of the month or whatever. And now that local business, that local auto shop, right, that was already, you know, struggling with stuff, now they're seeing increased business, right? And it's now diving, like driving stuff back into the economy. Because, right, like we're investing in people. You know, what happens when, you know, let's say, for example, you know, somebody doesn't have car insurance, right? Or somebody doesn't have a license, you know, is there some sort of program we can invest into getting people those resources, right? Into paying for that? Because again, if we're going to pay for their incarceration, right, we can pay for them to get the resources that they need. You know, oftentimes, right, like it would be much more cost effective to just give people the resources they need as opposed to incarcerating them, you know? So with that being said, I think having that sort of political imagination and then, right, like limiting and reducing or completely eliminating the ways in which law enforcement interacts with the public, I think, you know, there's this sort of like really, really problematic need of law enforcement to want to be everything for everyone, right? You know, like we don't need you to be basketball coaches. We have great coaches here to do that. You know, we don't need you to run after school programs. There are great community-based organizations that can do that. You know, two of our partners, the Brotherhood of State and Social Justice Learning Institute, they run this program called BLOOM, Building Lifelong Opportunities and Options for Men, specifically created for Black male youth, right? And they were able to reduce recidivism by over 90% in a span of like 6 years, right? So, you know, for Black male youth who were arrested, you know, they were able to have over 90% of the young people who went through their programs not reoffend and not rearrest, right? So when we're talking about like that, we already have solutions. They exist. They're out there. They're moving, right? Like, I think what we need to do is we need to invest in those solutions, and we need to, I think, begin to reimagine, right, like what it is that public safety is and does, right? You know, and as we're talking about specific policy interventions, right, the stuff that's coming in city council around changing who responds to certain issues or you know, maybe even taking law enforcement off of traffic stops or whatever these things are, right? Like, the more we continue to push on those, I think the closer we'll get to that reimagined public safety piece, where public safety is no longer a racialized term to harm Black folks and to harm communities of color. It will be changed to where we care about people first. We're not just trying to control them.
That's a good point, to where public safety actually says, actually does what it says, keeps the public safe.
And I feel that just real fast, because I know we don't have a lot of time, but I think, you know, David just demonstrated exactly the point, which I think we need to keep focused on, and that is...
Come closer to the mic.
He just illustrated the point that I think we need to focus on when we're talking about these things, which is to devising solutions and strategies is much better done by people who live in the experience, who have the personal experience, by community residents, by people with backgrounds in these various fields, and not by law enforcement. So it's foolish, frankly, to expect or to allow law enforcement to start defining what it will and will not do. If their purpose is to protect and serve, and we should be defining how they and what they do to protect and serve. So, you know, I'm absolutely in agreement with defunding the police strategies, even dismantling the police. I think we do need a total redefinition of what public safety means. And all of these other functions would not just be better done by trained and committed and principled experts or staff, or just, you know, people with background and commitment to do traffic, mental health response, interpersonal relationships, you know, disputes with your neighbors, drug treatment and prevention, all the schooling functions. There's no logic to making those police functions. And unfortunately, in many instances, police departments have been chasing these lines of funding for decades. They've been going after and bidding on dollars to address homelessness, when that doesn't make any sense at all. And it just creates these risks that we're seeing over and over again turn into horrible outcomes when police show up with a gun to a dispute about somebody laying in the sidewalk or something like that. You know, something, not even a dispute, but just their call to respond to something that you don't need a police officer to respond to. So that's one point. But the other point we really need to make sure we stay on top of is not just taking the money away from police or the responsibility away from police, but being involved as community residents and members in deciding how it does get spent and where it does go. And so, again, David just illustrated how that's done effectively by people in those thoughtful roles in conjunction and partnership with community residents rather than with police. But then the last point I really want to make, and that is, as effective as the strategies are that David, all of those strategies that he came up with would work, and all of them, all the strategies that you're hearing floated by other activists and advocates of community residents have a real shot at working. And this isn't the first time or the second time or the fifth time or more that determined and committed community residents, advocates, representatives haven't come up with strategies. But the thing we need to stay on top of is the implementation of it, the follow-through. And the follow-through requires that we tackle the big elephant in the room, and that's the racism. Because the racism will take you back every single time. It's that, you know, very insidious little force that will protect itself to underscore this false white supremacy attitude. And so, you know, the perversion of saying we want less resources to go to government that then creates private prisons. That's crazy. And private prisons morph into private immigration detention centers, morph into, you know, armed security patrols. We just giving the money to the private sector doesn't take care of the problem. And so that's because we haven't gotten to the underlying cause in the first place, which is this institutional, structural, systemic racism that is so insidious in our society. So yes to the reforming, reimagining, transforming public safety, but always in conjunction with tackling the larger problem of racism in our society.
Absolutely, absolutely. For any of the people here, if you have questions, go ahead and put them in the chat. You submit them now. We have about 15 minutes left, but while we get the questions together for you all, I have one more question for you, Mary Lee. What feels different about this moment of community organizing and narrative change, or does it feel the same?
So people have been asking me that, and I've thought about that too. I want so much for it to feel different. I really do. I want to say I'm optimistic or cautiously hopeful or all of those things, and to say that there's a broader scope and spectrum of allies, and there's multiracial, intersectional representation showing up to talk about these things. But I'm a little bit cynical, sorry, because I've seen that too. There were white abolitionists. There were allies throughout the struggle that humanity has had for human rights, for civil rights, for racial justice. We don't seem to be able to maintain this. And I'm already worried about how the attention span, the popular culture's attention span, will wane when the work really gets hard. And it's always hard, but we need that laser focus, that refusal to do anything until we get this out there and are working on it. And I'm not yet able to say that it feels different. I think the enormity of it and the international focus of it is very powerful. So it is, there's no question it's not a very, very powerful moment. And it has captured, you know, the imagination of people on many, many platforms. But we need to make that real, and we need to follow through. You're not gonna undo 400 or 500 years of history in 4 or 5 months. We have to stay on this for a very long time, for many generations.
Agreed. We have a question for you, David. The question is, we have made much progress in defunding the police. Do you think it is possible to abolish the police?
I'll say this. Anything is possible. We didn't think that, you know, a month and a half ago we would be here, but look where we are, right? I think it's one thing to abolish the police. It's another thing to abolish the logic that underscores policing, right? So to give you an example of what this looks like, right? I'll use education, right? One of the things that we know about in schools is that oftentimes, students experience a really hostile climate from everybody that they encounter, whether we're talking about teachers, whether we're talking about security guards, whether we're talking about school police, principals, counselors, other administrators. They experience this hostile climate, right? You know, because there is this deep and ingrained hatred, right? You know, for kids of color, Black kids specifically, right? So if that's the case, right, then yeah, we can remove police from schools, right? You know, and what about the rest of the climate of the school, right? So, I think police abolition is absolutely possible. You know, I think it is possible to work on, to organize on, to continue to do. I think the challenge is how do we address that underlying climate and incessant need to control certain people, certain bodies, certain populations, and not just control them, but also to make sure that their social positioning continues to be subservient. right? As we are working to abolish the police, we can't lose sight of that. Another thing too that I want to raise real quick is that in this country, in the United States, after one system of oppression has been eradicated or destroyed or addressed, another one immediately takes its place, right? So if we're looking at Black folks, we talk about, slavery, and then you have, the settler colonization of the entire, of this entire continent, right? Then from there, here in the United States, we ended enslavement, but then, Black Code started, then Jim Crow started, right? Then you end Jim Crow and de jure segregation, right? And now, this sort of sophisticated socioeconomic plus racialized oppression begins to take place where communities are divested from. And then what is invested in is the over criminalization and control of those populations, right? So literally after every system gets destroyed, another one takes its place. It's going to be important for us to foresee what that looks like, to foresee it, and then to make sure that we ingrain in our organizing safeguards to prevent it. To give you an example, like one of the things that community folks at the county level have pushed back on around instituting youth diversion was having really close ties with police. For those who may not know, diversion for young people in the county and across the state of California is when a young person gets arrested, and let's say they get arrested for spray painting on a wall or graffiti or something like that. Instead of them going to juvenile hall for it or having to have a punitive response, they'll then get diverted to, let's say, a youth arts program like Arts for Incarcerated Youth Network or something like that to receive services as opposed to going to juvenile hall, right? So what the people like the Youth Justice Coalition and the folks with the LA Youth Uprising Coalition have been organizing around, right, is when we do diversion, it shouldn't just be something where now we're going to have community have really close ties with law enforcement, and now community folks and community organizations are now going to become the new police to control these kids. Right. That's not what people are working on. And that's not what people want to happen. Right. But I think it took the community's foresight to see that, oh, that's what they were trying to do to us, to have us become the stand in for that. So we have to make sure that we address it. So it's going to take a certain level of foresight, right, for us to see that, like, look, we can't continue to allow these folks to one, splinter us, and then two, try to recreate these new systems and try to recreate these new systems of control that we then buy into, right? We just have to have the foresight to think about that and to, propose alternatives and to have new ways of engaging. So I say that to say that that as we're thinking about, like, what is to come and what we need to do, those are things that we need to keep in mind.
Jonathan Pacheco Bell says, thank you. Justin Bradley has a question for you, Mary Lee. Says, the follow-through is key, and addressing the racism is huge, because dealing with people who don't want to change or do not see the need for the change, it's as if you're asking a brick wall. Thank you for bringing it up, and the community economic empowerment plays a point in it as well. Do you agree? Do you?
Yeah, obviously we agree. The policing piece of it is, I think both David and I have made this point, it's the first rung of how racism is often encountered by people of color, particularly Black people. But that's the overt way it's affecting us. But the ways that are more subtle, you mentioned one, Marlo, which is health. Our economic standing and stature is absolutely been confined by centuries of racism. And so, we've alluded a couple of times today to the point of gentrification. I would add redlining to that. The forces that look on the surface like they're racially neutral, have nothing to do with people of color. They just happen to be systems that banks have put into place, real estate agencies have put into place, but they're absolutely racialized. And again, they're not broken. They're working the way they were intended to, and that is to extract wealth and labor and then to prevent other people from competing, people of color particularly, Black people particularly, of competing in our society. And so this system gets you in every level, education, income, jobs, job growth and possibility, food. We even talk about, you know, food access, another component to health, another component to living in neighborhoods that are segregated and designed to be disadvantaged. These are the tentacles of racism that we always feel. And yet, when you talk to people about this moment that we're facing, there's a kind of a desire, I think, to have an interpersonal reckoning. Let's talk about the way that individuals interact with each other on the basis of race and wanting to be anti-racist and wanting to be allies. And all of those things are absolutely, that's the personal work that people have to do. But we also need to understand that people enforce and operate systems, but sometimes they operate systems without even being aware that they are. So my favorite one to talk about is zoning, zoning and land use. Systems that are inherently racist, the people that are at the wheel right now may not even know that and may not necessarily intend that, but it doesn't really matter because the operation is using land use policy to separate people, advantage one group and disadvantage another. And that's what privilege looks like. Privilege looks like people being advantaged who may not have asked for it and may not be aware of it, but they certainly benefit from it. And by contrast, those who are oppressed are hurt in ways that they aren't even conscious of most of the time and would be hard pressed to dismantle by themselves. The systems have to be taken down. And so people will ask, how do you do that? Slowly, consistently, being intentional about prioritizing those who've been put at the bottom. They have to come first, even if that's not getting everybody the same equal share of an advantage. It may mean, and I think in our situation, it has to mean devoting resources, time, attention, priority to the needs of Black communities, the needs of Black individuals, the needs of Black students, the needs of Black women, and on and on and on, very deliberately. And that goes against all of the stuff that has been ingrained into our society, that we should be colorblind, that we need equal opportunity. These, frankly, distract us from what's really been happening in our society for so long. Mm-hmm. It's a really tough and uncomfortable conversation, but I actually think there's no way around them. There's absolutely no way. You can't get around it. You got to go through it.
That's a great point. Justin says, he thanks you and he says, can he reach out to you personally? Okay. Jennifer Rodriguez, she asks of both of you, what do you all think about the county's move towards closing the Men's Central Jail?
I'm looking at some of the chat, and I'll try to address a couple of things. So I think, right, first off, our folks from Justice LA, you know, were a part of that and have been working on that for a very long time. And I'm really excited for it because I think, you know, so my cousin, DJ, right now, he's currently incarcerated at Soledad. And one of the things that he went through is that he was stuck in the county jail system for 18 months. And he ended up taking a plea deal because he just wanted to get his time over with, you know, and right. Like the county jail system is so hostile and so bad, right. That he said, I would rather just go to prison and take my time than be here, you know? So, you know, I'm excited that Men's Central is closing, because again, that institution is just decrepit and doesn't need to exist. I think with regard, like, as we're thinking about, somebody had asked earlier about abolition, you know, what does it mean to get rid of these particular institutions? The important work of abolition is to make sure that we're building in other supports in place, right? You know, so that way, as things go away, you know, we can still, or we can address that a key need, right? Angela Davis, you know, one of her more famous quotes is that, you know, jails and prisons don't disappear social problems, they disappear people, right? You know, it's them trying to disappear people so that they can get rid of the problem. And to be honest, our overinvestment in that has ensured that we don't invest in other really important major issues. So, for example, one of our partners at the Labor Community Strategy Center, they do work not only around the policing and what happens on Metro with the bus riders union, but they also do work around climate change, right? And that's something that literally affects all of us, right? Because we all got to breathe at some point. But it's like, we also got to think too, in the areas that have the highest concentration of CO2 emissions and the areas that have the highest concentration of pollution, right? In the areas that, like, for example, even in Black Beverly Hills, it's right next to a tar pit and oil field, right? You know, whether we're talking about Baldwin Hills or we look at the Black middle class neighborhoods in Carson, right, that are all around large oil fields, right? So literally, you know, there is no escaping anti-Blackness regardless of what field we're in. I think the issue is that because we overinvest in one thing, we haven't been able to invest in the solutions to address the other stuff, right? So so once we begin to divest, right, you know, from those to divest from those other pieces, right, it will then be important for community to determine what the investment in the other things look like, what the investment in the other things address, because once we do that, right, then we'll be able, I think, to really begin to move towards a society that is more interested in health and a lot less interested in control.
That's a good point. Barbara La Collins from the Strategy Center was actually asking, how do we address climate change? And you answered it right. then. I appreciate that. But everybody also wants to know how they can follow you guys, how they can keep in touch with you. Do you have websites, your social media handles, anything you can share with us? I'll go to you, Mary Lee, first.
You don't want to go to me first because I'm an old dog and I don't have a lot of the newfangled social media context. I'm working on it, but for right now, I'm old school.
How about leaving us with a sense of hope, something that we can cling on to, something that we can start working on now. Mary.
All right. Hope. I think about my kids when I try to be hopeful, and I see the beauty in that. And that is hope, that I'm extraordinarily inspired by the young people that are feeling this and insisting and demanding change and are speaking out about what their communities need, what they need for themselves. I find so much hope and so much power in that. The Black Lives Matter movement's power, and that is, seems like a long time since Trayvon Martin was murdered, and yet in the scheme of things, it's a relatively brief time, and they're capturing really the spirit of this moment, and I think that's extraordinarily hopeful. Even, and David said this too, the fact that we're having conversations about rethinking public safety none of the stuff that is being proposed has necessarily happened in the last 5 months. People have been talking about this for a long time, but being able to have this as a national conversation wouldn't have been possible without the pressure and the urgency that's been fostered by what I think particularly the young voices have pushed. So that's where I see hope. I just want to make sure that there's you know, the consistency and people stay on it and stay focused on it and don't let it go. You cannot let it go until, because it's going to take a lot to dismantle all these systems and structures and attitudes that we've been talking about this morning.
How about that? Until. And okay, so since you don't have any social media, how can people find you?
So I have an email. I guess I'll put it in the chat and that way people can see it. I'll do that right now.
Perfect. David Turner, the third. How can people find you?
So you can find me via social media, Dr_Kunta23. That's my Instagram. Twitter is Team Progress 23, TEAM Progress 23. So you can definitely find me that way. I think in closing words, I have a small quote. Is it okay if I can read it?
Please.
Yeah. So, in a documentary connected to the Ferguson uprising, Reverend Sekou had said this in that documentary, and I think it's one of the most powerful things I've seen. It's going to go in my dissertation for sure. But he said, "I've lost hope in the possibility of America. My faith lies in nothing else than these young people and their righteous indignation. That I'm inspired by a generation that has been betrayed by every civic institution, by every level of government, every facet of civil society has betrayed them. Their only option is to continue to take to the street. The only reason you and I are having this conversation is because they continue to take to the streets and they continue to refuse to bow down." So I say that to say that, that as we're thinking about, you know, this particular moment, you know, like what gives me hope is that the people are tired. The people are frustrated. The people are ready for change. And, you know, if I'm always willing to bet, I'm willing to bet on the side of the people, you know? So with that being said, right, like, I think what gives me hope in this moment is the fact that we have young folks, we have communities who are rising up and who are not going to take it anymore. So, I'm excited about it. I'm excited to be, you know, to play a role in this particular movement. And just really ready to continue to advance his work. So let's do it.
Amazing. Thank you both. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, David. Thank you, Oshanae. Thank you, everybody who's attended. Make sure that you follow, you subscribe, share, and like South Central Rooted. Until then, stay rooted, South LA.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest DigiLab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.